My name is Theo Sandvoort. I'm a professor at Columbia University, and I'm the discussant for this session. I'll try to organize some lively discussion here. And I'm also one of the speakers, and I'm also going to introduce the two speakers. There are some changes in the program that will be explained to you. This is a very special session. This is the session of the HIV/AIDS section chair, and that currently is Brian Dodge. And he gave as a title for his session, Global Perspectives on Sexual Health Among Diverse MSM and MSMWs. Global is, of course, very global, and we will limit the talks to India and South Africa. And last night, when Brian and I had dinner, we discovered that, even though that may sound strange, but there are a lot of parallels between South Africa and India that probably will come out in the talks. This is a very special session for a variety of reasons. 7 years ago, also in Boston, we had the first session that was focused on bisexuality, and Brian was the one who organized that. 7 years later, he's back as the chair of the section, and he has a new session, again, about the same issue. People in this room probably are familiar with the word or the concept of MSM. That was introduced at the end of the 80s, when people discovered in the context of AIDS that a lot of homosexual transmission took place and that men were involved who didn't identify as gay. So to acknowledge that, they developed a new concept, and it was men who have sex with men. In a way, it was a step forward, but at the same time, when that step was set, it was also a step backwards. Because what happened subsequently is that that concept of MSM, and Brian at least makes the distinction between MSM and MSMWs, but that is something that people usually don't do. That concept became a very monolithic concept. We have programs for MSM, as if all these MSM are the same. And you will see today in this session that is definitely not the case. And we probably can discuss with each other what the consequences are for research as well as for prevention and policy. There are, of course, alternatives for that word. People have tried to come up with new names, for instance, GMT, gay men with sex with men, and transgender women, as a very inclusive, broader term that at least acknowledges that in this group of MSM there are also transgender women who are born biologically male but who are either transitioning or trying to live the life of the opposite gender, the gender that they feel that they belong to. But GMT, concept introduced by MFAR, is not really taking off yet. Maybe it will in the future, and that will at least acknowledge that the MSM category is much broader than just that single word. Related to that is an interesting question, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that. Does identity really matter? The concept of MSM in a way makes clear that it's about behavior. It's not who you are, but it's about what you do and what you don't do, not using a condom. That puts you at risk for HIV. Does identity, does identifying as one or the other or this or that, does that really matter in terms of HIV prevention? And this is something that we can talk about later. Brian is going to make some announcements about what's going on in the program, how things have changed. But I want to introduce him first before he comes up. He is associate professor at Indiana University in Bloomington. And he is, I think, the co-director, I should know, of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion. He's a former fellow of mine. I run a postdoc program at Columbia University for behavioral research in HIV. Behavioral research in HIV, I think that's it. And he graduated from the program about 2005, 8 years ago. He was the very first fellow that I had. It was quite an adventure, and I'm incredibly proud of what he has accomplished. Brian.
Thanks, Theo. Hi, everyone. It really is actually a special day for a variety of reasons, but as Theo mentioned, as my former mentor in the Behavioral Science Research and HIV Infection Fellowship, Teo, you should know as the training director the name, and for a variety of reasons that that I'll come back to at the end. I really wouldn't be here today standing in front of you right now if it weren't for this man right here, Teo Sanfort. So just want to acknowledge that in the beginning, and I'll come back to it when we close. But that said, again, this is also a special day because 7 years ago we did have for the HIV section the first ever special session on Black and Latino bisexual men, : gender, context, and culture. And at that point, we had just finished a pilot study in New York City looking at behaviorally bisexual Black men. And Miguel Munoz Laboy, who's also in the room somewhere, hi, was presenting some of his incredible work that he's been doing with Latino men. Mark Padilla, David Malabranch, several other really near and dear colleagues were sharing our work, which at that time, with the whole, you know, sort of discourse that was going on after the bombshell episode of Oprah Winfrey on the down low and all of the, you know, conversations that were happening at that time, it was really something. It was a full house. It was a room probably twice as big as this. And it was really special. Yeah, it was an interesting moment. I'd like to think that we've come a long way since then, but I'm not sure necessarily societally how far we've come since that. But at the very least, you know, a few years later, a few grants later, a few different collaborations later, I'm here today to share some really interesting and hopefully you'll find too innovative work that I've started in Mumbai, India. It's a collaboration with my colleague Swagata Banik, who I'll come back to in just a moment, who, as well as Vivek Anand, who's at the Hump Safar Trust in Mumbai, Murgesh, who's also at the Hump Safar Trust, and then my doctoral student, Jessamine Bowling, and Michael Reese, who's the director at the Center for Sexual Health Promotion. Although we do end up talking about disclosure a lot in these presentations, I have nothing to disclose in terms of financial relationships. And we'll come back to that because that is an important issue. But for Swagata. Swagata is actually here standing in the middle of the back row with the turtleneck on. He's a very wonderful person. And standing next to him was his brother, Sukanta. I was really fortunate enough to go to India last January and traveled around and had an amazing experience getting the work off the ground associated with this study. And I got to spend some real quality time with Swagata's family. And some of you may know, just 2 days ago, Saturday was Diwali, which is a major sacred Indian holiday. Swagata had just landed here in Boston, and I got a series of calls from him on Saturday night. And unfortunately, Sukanta died on Saturday, on Diwali, which is a real big loss. He was a really wonderful person. Actually was the instrumental reason for me going to the Taj Mahal that day, because it had been such a dream, and took like a month's wages to rent a truck and bring us there, and just was such a wonderful person, and died at the age of 32 of a stroke, which I think says a lot about the life that a lot of people live there too. So anyhow, I'm hoping, if nothing else, that he's here with us today in spirit and that we can just take a minute to remember him, and not only Sukanta, but also Swagata, because without him, I really would not be here sharing this. We met, we connected, we collaborated. You know, there were so many, as Teo said, parallels with, you know, we were talking last night about India and South Africa, but also with India and, you know, some subpopulations in the United States. And the way that we were able to go over there and the collaborations that were set up and just, you know, everything that I'm sharing today really is a collaborative effort. And also I'm going to be sharing Swagata's presentation on the Hijra population, the stigma with Hijra and healthcare providers after our second talk, because Swagata isn't with us, but because it is really such a special study that I want to be sure to, hopefully I won't be able to do it justice as Swagata would, but at least to share that with you too. So, on a brighter note, HIV and other STI, obviously everyone in the room knows that they're a public health priority here domestically, but globally as well. And in India in particular, approximately 2.5 million people currently living with HIV, and those rates are questionable as to how, you know, how they may be on the low end in terms of diagnosis or, you know, approximate numbers of infection. Predominant mode of infection or transmission is through sexual activity. And in India, as with in South Africa, as with in the United States, and as with really everywhere in the world that we reduce people to acronyms, this notion of MSM really is limiting and problematic. Because there has been a high prevalence of HIV found in select samples of MSM in India from anywhere from 7 to 24%, that's a quarter of individuals in that population. There's also been high rates of sexual behavior noted with both male and female partners, and also high rates of sexual behavior among men who are married to women who are also engaging in sexual behavior with other men and other women at times too. And part of that may have to do with the fact that over 90% of all marriages in India currently are still arranged. And this is a huge issue, culturally a big difference until you go over there and you see it and sort of, you know, are immersed in it. It was hard for me to understand. But I think that is a subset of behaviorally bisexual men, the married MSM, but they're also distinct from who we're going to be talking about today, although there may be some overlap. But regardless, a large proportion of the men who have sex with men in India are actually men who are having sex with both men and women. And they're rarely acknowledged as such, except as a potential bridge population from, you know, kind of creeping around on their presumably monogamous female partners with other male partners and, you know, infecting them with HIV or other STI during that process. And what was interesting to me is, again, as someone who hadn't been to India before, but who had, you know, read a lot and just been exposed to a lot through, you know, doing my PhD at Indiana University, working at the Kinsey Institute and seeing, you know, amazingly beautiful art and artifacts from India where there really is a history, like a sacred history of sexuality, and where bisexuality in particular, you know, held a very special status in some places and, you know, was not only accepted but revered. And it wasn't until colonialism came swooping in, as it did here in the United States as well, and destroyed that whole system, you know, that we kind of are where we are today. But there is that special history. And so part of me thought, well, you know, that said, and with these high rates of reported behavioral bisexuality, like, where is that today? And interestingly, when we got over there and when I did this first day we spent at the community-based organization, Hum Safar Trust, I noticed this campaign. It jumped out at me as someone who studies HIV and sexual behavior and sexual health among bisexual men. I thought, wow, my God, there's a targeted campaign toward behaviorally bisexual men right there. And it says, it happens. A man may be attracted to both a woman as well as a man. Whoever your partner is, always be safe. Always use condoms. You might notice it also is partially sponsored by USAID. And while I was really excited initially when I saw this, the more that I looked at it, and I remembered, Teo, if you remember back 7 years ago, with the posters on the billboards of the men on the down low, of the man, you know, with his wife and the baby in her arms, with his arm around her, and the shady-looking male character in the back, you know, kind of drawing him away from her. And there's a lot going on in this image as well. And I think, you know, while these messages obviously are of great importance, the way that we deliver them and the way that they're interpreted and understood, and also how they're processed by people to whom they're actually targeted for, is something that I'm really interested in. That said, in terms of background as well, HIV prevention efforts, there's particularly even targeted toward bisexual men, are most often, as with here, grouped together with homosexual men under the label MSM. There's little attention given to the context, experiences, and impact of their sexual behaviors and relationships with female partners and transgender partners in particular. And transgender is an interesting issue in India. I'm going to use that today as sort of an umbrella term, but when I present Swagata's data, you'll see, just as with sexuality and sexual identity labels and behavioral subgroups, there are really interesting and unique subgroups of transgender, what we would call individuals, that have existed for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I'm really excited because we have a special colleague with us from Bangladesh too, we get little, if any, information about Bangladesh, and I'm excited to see how these things differ even with the nation next door. It's not known whether bisexual men in India face distinct psychosocial challenges in comparison to exclusively homosexual and heterosexual men. We know that from work that we've done here in the United States, this is definitely the case. We've put out several papers where bisexual men say that they perceive and experience real stigma from both heterosexual and gay and lesbian counterparts, that they don't really have a place to fit in, that there's a great deal of sort of chaos in some ways about, you know, feeling like they're the only ones in many cases, or were the only ones. And I think I was particularly interested with the context of India that was the same, or again, knowing this historical backdrop of, you know, sexual diversity and how it was in some ways sacred, and other times whether that would still be the case. In overall, information on how unique behavioral and psychosocial and community level factors are associated with bisexual men's health and behaviors and how those might be amenable to intervention is really relatively unknown. So that said, the aims of this particular project, and this is a very developmental pilot project using a community-based perspective, I'll define that in just a moment, but long story short, empirically defining and describing the meaning of bisexuality among diverse samples of self-identified behaviorally bisexual men who are both behaviorally bisexual and self-identify as bisexual. I'll explain the target population in just a minute, but it's really interesting to note, over maybe 10 years ago now, Teo knows, when I initially started in this work with bisexual men, I was very interested actually in self-identified bisexual men. And for a number of reasons, including, you know, getting integrated into the reality of the NIH, you know, funding system and risk relevance, et cetera, I came to, you know, almost eschew identity entirely as this fuzzy concept, as people say. And how does that does it relate to risk behavior? We were just having this conversation last night. But this is a special group of behaviorally bisexual men, and I'll explain them more in just a minute. To identify the sociocultural determinants related to their behaviors that may put them at risk for HIV and STI acquisition and transmission, both with male and female and transgender partners, and to look at also just the feasibility of engaging these men in a research study, particularly if we're thinking about doing any sort of behavioral or other types of interventions down the road. Those of you who have done work in India know that it's not the same. You don't put up a flyer somewhere and people tear down a number and participate. It's a very different context, just recruiting and engaging people into behavioral science research, let alone that focused on, you know, such a particular subpopulation. So when I say this was a community partnership, it really was between IU, Swagata's institution, Baldwin Wallace University in Cleveland, and the Hum Safar Trust, which is the oldest and largest LGBT-focused service organization in India. They've had an incredible history of not only responding in terms of HIV/AIDS, but a variety of other health issues for LGBT broadly defined populations in India. We have an MOU that's the basis of a wide range of different research, educational, and service activities that we're currently planning and proposing and putting at least proposals for funding out there for. And despite the research expertise and capacity of all of us involved at our partner institutions, again, it became readily apparent that the projects like this really can't occur without partnership and community participation. Just walking out on the street, you know, in that setting for me was a different experience. And again, learning to transpose or in some way use our research, you know, framework process in a setting like that just took a lot of working with people who are on the ground there. So the exploratory research process first, the steps in this exploratory study were focus groups of bisexual men in order to determine recruitment venues and review and standardize the instrument that we're going to use for structured interviews, and then conduct 50 structured interviews with a diverse sample of bisexual men looking at sexual behaviors, risk behavior, relationships, identity, wide range of other variables, and then analyzing the data, writing up papers, and submitting grant proposals. And today, again, just because of some of the logistical issues that come up in those settings where they don't necessarily work on the same timelines that we do here in the United States, I'm going to share just the data from the first couple exploratory focus groups. I think there's some really interesting things in here just within the focus groups as a starting point, but there's a lot more to come out of this. And we're now on our third participant that we've recruited for interviews, and hopefully next year by this time we'll have more data to share from the actual interview process. Just a little about Mumbai for those who haven't been there, who aren't familiar, but it does have 13 million inhabitants in the metropolitan area, and actually within this, you know, next decade, it's anticipated to more than double. So we're really, when we're talking about Mumbai as, you know, having public health significance, this is one of the most heavily populated areas on Earth. It's also one of the most disparate in terms of, you know, socioeconomic status, access to care, all of the issues that many of us in this room deal with every day. And just being aware of that, that Mumbai is not New York City, it's not San Francisco, it's not Bloomington, Indiana, that's for sure. It's a unique context. And in terms of the population, again, because there's been little done on bisexual men in India, that which has been done has most often included either MSMW, the behavioral category alone, or this group of married MSM, who are characterized usually as primarily homosexually oriented men who are put into arranged relationships with women. And again, when we sat down at the table and talked about who we were going to focus on in the study, I kept coming back and saying, we need to focus on the behavioral bisexuality. That's really in terms of risk relevance and what's, you know, going to be most important in terms of, you know, public health implications at the end of the day. And the people around the table said, well, that's MSMW. And I said, yeah, that's right. And they said, no, but you want to focus on bisexual men. And I said, yeah, and they said, but MSMW and bisexual men are not the same thing. So I proceeded to learn about a whole host of different subgroups of behavioral bisexual men, everything from, again, you know, the sort of married MSM to the fully sort of oriented bisexual men to these groups of truckers who drive long hauls from Delhi through Afghanistan and are married and migrant workers, but who are paired up with younger adolescent boys who help them to, you know, apprentice while they're driving the trucks and are actually viable sexual partners for them, to sex work, which is a big category of behaviorally bisexual men in this context. A lot of different subgroups that I wasn't familiar with, even some that I still am coming to understand. How and whether identity manifests itself in terms of HIV risk and perception among bisexual men in India, on their side was what was really most important. And because studies haven't looked at the context, patterns, and meanings of sexual relationships with partners depending on gender, that was going to be a key element of anything that we were going to do. But again, sexual behavior and identity categories in India can be situational and very fluid, even more so than in other contexts. And there are realistic environmental structure, socioeconomic factors that drive the formation of sexual behavior and identity. This quote, for example, I didn't have any knowledge about these things. I entered the field professionally for money, but gradually it became my hobby, and now I can do with both man and woman. So who is this person now? You know, he may have been classified as the sort of sex work subgroup before, but now he's actually found through the sex work that he enjoys sex with both men and women. So there's a lot, again, a lot going on there in regards to the context. And based on guidance from the community partners that we're working with, the specific subset of men that we're focusing on in this project are behaviorally bisexual men who also self-identify as bisexual. Basically, I think the closest cultural equivalent that we would have here are just men who are bisexually oriented, who are attracted and sexually active with both male and female partners, who may be actively seeking out both male and female partners, with whom it's not just a financial issue or an issue of convenience or access or any of the other factors, men who are just bisexual. So in terms of the focus group themes, I'll just go over these themes very quickly and show you some examples of three of them in particular. But already in the focus groups, we've unearthed some really interesting findings. The first domain was about identity, and we found a wide range of different reasons why men were using the word bisexual, including attraction to both men and women, that being an accurate reflection of their actual behavior, being labeled by other people as bisexual, and then also, again, using bisexual, but also using many other terms. And we found this in other studies of behaviorally bisexual men, and probably people in general, right? We know this from work from Lisa Diamond and other people, that identity, what I identify as right now, may be different 5 minutes from now. And we definitely caught some of that. In terms of disclosure, and I put that in quotes because I really am kind of tired of how that, you know, is tied, particularly for behaviorally bisexual people, to HIV risk and related issues, as if that would be any different from any other person who is sexually active, and whether or not they have to confess their entire sexual history or, you know, close sensitive information about themselves before engaging in sexual activity with a partner. But regardless, we did find there is quite a bit of cultural silence around bisexuality. There's a great deal of stigma. I'll show you some detailed quotes of this in a few minutes, that they're much less likely to disclose to female partners, again, only if female partners ask. And that was something that came out from when we were working in the Black Bisexual Men's Study in the United States as well. And also not disclosing for sort of protective reasons, not wanting to hurt their female partners. And less likely to disclose to other men who were not also bisexual because of stigma, wrath, and other issues, you know, from exclusively gay men that they may be having relationships or sexual activity with. Societal influences, there was a clear, in the family context I put as a separate bullet, but this really, you know, comes together. There was a clear pressure and societal expectation of marriage and children above all, and that there was significant stigma within the family context. Interestingly, there was also just in the media and in society in general, the term bisexual had been, you know, becoming more popular. And I think, you know, men talked about, oh, well, there are men who go on these web, you know, discussion boards, sort of similar to what our Craigslist would be, and they post that they're bisexual because, you know, everyone wants bisexual men or what they perceive them to be. There's also a great deal there of labeling people based on sexual positioning. There are very clear categories for men who take the insertive role in anal sex with a male partner versus the receptive role, and a lot of sort of baggage that go along and expectations that go along with both of those. And that's now developing around the word bisexual as well. In terms of sexual behaviors and relationships with anal sex, most of these men, and again, these are just the preliminary focus groups, almost exclusively engaging in anal sex with male partners. There were men who reported anal sex with female partners, but that it was painful for their female partners or that they saw it as degrading. And this is a nod to Miguel, your work with the Latino men about on this continuum of sort of being compartmentalized and being fluid in terms of sexual behavior, whether or not if you engage in oral sex, you engage in that with both men and women, or that's only something you do with men. You know, you don't go down on women, but you enjoy performing oral sex on men. This compartmentalization of sexual behaviors was very clear with anal sex. It was seen as something taboo with female partners, but something that was often engaged in with the hijra, particularly hijra sex workers, and we'll come to that in just a few minutes. Very interesting. Oral sex, men reported that female partners were often unwilling and that male partners just did a better job. We've heard that before in other cultural contexts too, although some people would argue that fact. That's a whole nother study. Sex work, it was also a common entry into same-sex behavior again, but the men that we had at this point, again, even if they had started, you know, their bisexual activity in the context of sex work, had come to, you know, enjoy or seek out sexual activity with both male and female partners. And in terms of preference for gender, we did ask this question. We ask it in a lot of our studies. You know, I don't like this idea of having people choose if you had to choose a male partner or a female partner. But again, it was something that we were interested in particular with this group, with all of the work that's been done characterizing these married MSM as, you know, tragic cases of men who would otherwise be happy gay men, but they were put into arranged marriages with women and really painted to be a very sad story. Most of the men in the groups preferred male partners for sexual versatility, not just for sexual activity, but because you could do a lot of different types of sexual activity with them, not just penile-vaginal intercourse, and preferred female partners for intimate and fulfilling relationships. And obviously there were personal, societal, logistical factors related to this that I'll show you in just a moment too. And then in terms of determinants of risk, as with our samples of behaviorally bisexual men in the United States, condoms were actually fairly consistently used for anal sex, insertive and receptive with male partners. One issue, though, in terms of potential risk is that many of the men were initiated into sex by older male partners, and often in these public sex environments, on trains, in train stations, in restrooms, sort of, you know, on the fly. And when it, you know, that's a in terms of legality and the other police corruption and all of the other issues that go along with that, we know from previous work too that there tends to be less protective behaviors in those types of settings if men, you know, aren't necessarily prepared for it. Not always. In some ways, they can actually be protective. Men are less likely to engage in anal sex in a bathroom with each other, just because logistically it takes a lot of time and someone could come in. And then relative isolation, we found this very clearly too. There was really no bisexual community or resources, again, targeted specifically for bisexual men. So in terms of intervention opportunities, the men did talk about, you know, being willing to report their sexual behaviors with both male and female partners to a healthcare provider if there was a reason for doing so, if it related to why they were there, and if they were going to get proper care. And as we'll see with the Hijra in just a few minutes, there are very realistic reasons why these people do not seek care. They are discriminated against. In some cases, they're sexually assaulted in the context. And again, it's something that's difficult for some of us to fathom, but there are real reasons why you wouldn't just disclose your bisexual behavior to a healthcare provider. You could be thrown out on the street. And there's really no simple way to reach out to bisexual men. Word of mouth, advocacy organizations, the internet, some different possibilities were mentioned. We're going to probe more specifically for this in the interviews. But again, just the recruitment into the process itself, it is going to take some serious work. So I just want to share three of these themes and illuminate them with quotes. In particular, first, the gender preference, which dealt with personal, societal, and logistical issues. One participant, I would choose the girl because girls are softer. Boys do it in a better way, but if both are equally good, then I would choose the girl. And we've heard that from other samples of bisexual men, that women are softer, or women are, you know, more emotional, or women are safer in terms of HIV. We've heard that quite a bit. And then this participant, boys can do everything. They give you enjoyment and we get satisfied. Also means you can do anytime, anywhere with boys. But if you take a girl with you, people stare at you. That's where this boy is going and with whom he's going home. But with a boy, there's no question how much time you're spending with him, sleeping with him, you can continue enjoying. Really interesting. One of the first things you'll notice when you get off the plane there, and I remember this just from my days of living in Zimbabwe, that men and men together walk around holding hands, embracing, cuddling, almost, you know, like, wow, get a room. You know, I mean, there's some really intense touching that goes on. And you don't see that with male-female couples. And so this participant is saying, you know, in terms of gossip and chatter and everything, if I'm out with another guy and we're walking around, you know, cuddling on each other, no one's going to think anything of it. We're just friends. But if I'm doing that same thing with a woman, then I'm going to, you know, be branded as being shameful for doing that in public, or where are they going and what are they going to be doing? In terms of the disclosure, again, this is interesting because I just wanted to show some of the diversity beyond just the stereotypical images of, you know, what we're bombarded with constantly with non-disclosure among bisexual men. As with other contexts, discussions about bisexuality vary depending on a number of factors, including gender. Boys mostly know, but girls don't. Someone in this other participant telling a story that we've heard in other samples as well, someone told on the phone that I'm involved in all these things, and then she, my girlfriend, fought with me a lot, blamed me for such things. Now when I go to my hometown, you do sex with gay people, things like that, which again, is another reason not to disclose to someone if they're going to use that, you know, in a vengeful way against you. Or in other samples, we've had people whose female partners have said, if I ever found out that you were behaviorally or creeping around with other guys behind my back, I'd have my, you know, brother shoot you. And that is a reason not to disclose bisexual behavior to your partner. But diversity also does exist. This participant, for example, commitment is like, and he's open with his wife about his bisexuality. If my wife says tomorrow I want to enjoy with someone else, then I should be open. I should allow her that you can enjoy with someone else, because I'm enjoying my life, she has her life, and she can enjoy her life. She shouldn't divide the family, but that's the main thing. Really interesting, wow. We don't hear a whole lot about happy bisexual couples in India, and they're there. And then in terms of stigma and the need to adjust, as with other contexts, very few spaces, places, resources, no one wants to understand about this thing. And then the focus group leader, can any bisexual fit into a gay group? Yes, he can. Adjustment can be there in the community. Like in Humsafar, there's a place for everyone, gays, bisexuals, lesbians. There's a place in every group. But that depends on the adjustment, that how you can adjust yourself in that group. But is there any such bisexual group? Mostly, there is no such group. And interesting, again, too, that he talks about having to adjust yourself, right? Having to fit in. Maybe, you know, be a different person in order to fit into that group. So in terms of next steps, again, the structured interviews are exciting. They're now well underway. Logistical issues associated with data collection are challenging, but we're overcoming those through collaboration and partnership. The publication of our pilot data, hopefully over the upcoming year. One thing that resulted from the last special session that we did in 2006 was a special issue of Archives of Sexual Behavior, which included the papers from that special section. And now I'm an associate editor on that journal, so I think we can hopefully set something like that up again too, and it's a great publication. And strategically targeting a wide range of funding initiatives, US, India, Educational Foundation, NIH, lots of great ideas, very few far between resources, and particularly for something, you know, as this. We're open to lots of ideas and in terms of collaboration with other people who have ongoing activities as well in India. Please feel free to contact me, come to me afterwards, and I'll give you my contact info. So I'm just showing this again as sort of a closing slide because it's beautiful. It's on the beach in Mumbai, just down from the international airport. And it's sunset on a Sunday night. But I think it says a lot about sort of the expectations and then the reality of India for a non-Indian person. Having been there, I thought, wow, we're going to go down to the beach and watch the sunset, you know, and maybe there will be a few people like there are in the United States kind of scattered around. And there were literally, this was before the swarms came, but there were shoulder to shoulder people, thousands of people sprawled out on the beach, people walking down carrying racks of clothing, you know, selling clothing off of the rack, all kinds of vendors, just almost sheer chaos. But everyone seemed really happy, and there was actually some sort of method to the madness. And there, it's a really interesting place, and also a really different place. I'm still very much learning about it myself, and I hope to have the opportunity to learn much more. So that said, just really quick acknowledgments. Part of the salary support took place through another grant from National Institutes of Health, and our Office of the Dean at Indiana University School of Public Health provided the funds for travel and partnership-related costs. We're very grateful to the Humsafar Trust and to the participants who have taken part in the project. And again, I just want to give a shout out to my former, my eternal postdoctoral mentor, Dr. Teo Sanford of Columbia University, because there were quite a few bumps along the road in terms of getting this stuff up and running, and somehow he continued to see the need for evidence-based research on bisexual men, and I really will always appreciate that, and also for believing in me. Thank you.